Hello and welcome to the Bedrock Podcast. I'm Captain Steve Miller. 3 years ago, I interviewed Charlie Walker, a British pilot, about Night Fright, his C-47 aircraft. Night Fright was stationed at RAF Membury during World War II with the 436th Troop Carrier Group, the ancestor to Dover's modern-day 436th Operations Group. Walker purchased Night Fright a decade ago and has since been working tirelessly to restore her not just to flying condition, but to her D-Day level of detail. Now, as we approach D-Day's 80th anniversary on June 6, 2024, the finish line is in sight for Walker and his restoration team. I caught up with him a few weeks ago to recap the progress and discuss his future plans.
It's funny because if you wind the clock back 3 years and, you know, you walked into the hangar and, you know, you did the same now, you walked into the hangar up until very recently, there's probably not too many changes that I would describe as noticeable. You know, the devil is in the detail, really. That's the, you know, the guys working on all of the systems, you know, whether it's the hydraulic system, fuel system, oil system, a lot of the sort of what would I call it, World War II cosmetics, making the aircraft look like it would have done on the 6th of June 1944, both internally and externally. So, you know, they've been beavering away on all of those bits and pieces that people don't see up until very, very recently, probably the last sort of 2 to 3 months, where we've actually started applying the final paint scheme to the exterior of the aircraft, which is really what brings it to life, I guess. You know, we've spent over 10 years working on the project, and whilst there have been some really big visual changes, you know, as part of that, whether it's the center section and the fuselage being mated together, whether it's the engines going on, the props going on, probably I think, you know, the paint scheme is the most significant, because it's what gives Night Fright her sort of her true identity, really. So, you know, there's been a lot going on, whether it's system work, whether it's structural work, whether it's that sort of World War II sort of detail. But now we're very much on the home straight. As you say, it's hard to believe it's been 3 years since we caught up. We were aiming to be ready for the 75th anniversary of D-Day, which was, of course, 2019. And wind the clock forward, and we find ourselves on the cusp of the 80th anniversary of June this year in 2024.
In May, Night Fright experienced an issue with her hydraulic system, which required a few extra weeks' work.
You know, there's a huge amount of work to do, and probably in reality just a little bit too much work to do to hit D-Day 80. But I guess the as we would say in England, you know, the final nail in the coffin was the hydraulic issue. That's probably cost them 2 to 3 weeks, and it's not the problem itself, it's just time. It's time that we don't have, really. So yeah, that was a bit of a killer blow, really. But thankfully we've nearly resolved that, so we're catching up as quick as we can.
Unfortunately, Night Fright will be unable to fly on this year's anniversary, but Walker still has something special planned.
What we thought would be kind of cool is if we could at least run the engines on D-Day. So the plan is to push her outside the hangar and run the engines. And whilst we might not be getting airborne, that's a close second, I guess.
Walker's lead engineer is Neil Jones. By trade, Jones is a C-17 engineer for the Royal Air Force. He talked about his transition to learning the nuts and bolts of the C-47 for this project.
Weirdly, it's an easy transition. I think I think one of the most common things between the two aircraft, both built by Douglas / Boeing, in a way, both from the same Long Beach facility. So it's that's quite ironic that I'm working on two aircraft 8 years apart, in a way. And the tech orders, in a way, they're identical. In a way, obviously, there's a few nuances regarding how modern day tech orders are and more digitalized. We have the hard copy kind of TOs, which has our parts catalogs. And procedures and on how to kind of carry out structural repairs, et cetera, et cetera.
After the war, Night Fright flew for several civilian cargo carriers. This presented a challenge for Jones to equip the plane with her World War II military components.
So to get what we want back into the aircraft as the World War II configuration, needed all those components to be either sourced or fabricated, and the majority were fabricated, and that's where the parts catalogs came in useful from 1944, because that gave you the part number of the particular component you wanted to fabricate. You can then go then to the Douglas drawings to find that actual part number, and that gives you a full technical breakdown of the drawing of how how to fabricate, how to bend it, what type of aluminium it was made from, and then use modern day fabrication processes to make it so. A lot of it is handmade. It's quite bespoke in a way, Knight Frights, even though it's original drawing, conforming to original drawings, I suppose. But it's modern day kind of aluminium grades, which gives Knight Frights now a huge longevity. I think it's 1943 when Knight Frights was built. Douglas was spitting out C-40 sounds very, very quickly. Obviously, we've got a bit more time on our hands, which means quality control is high, as in nothing is scrimped on. Everything is to the book. And Knight Frights now will last way beyond my lifetime and into kind of the next generation, which is exactly what we're kind of trying to do anyway, is to kind of get that kind of seed planted in the next generation for the future, really.
When Walker purchased Knight Frights, he wanted to have her flying by D-Day's 75th anniversary in 2019. Now, 5 years after that initial goal, he reflected on the project's challenges.
I think Neil, feel free to chip in as well in a minute. But I mean, I think the whole thing has just been a massive challenge. If I look back 10 years ago, with what the aims of the project were, they were very different to what they are now. So I think the first sort of comment is to say that it's become a much bigger project generally than we ever expected. There's far more work, cost, detail, and everything involved, really. People often ask the question is, why is it such a big project? Why has it taken so long? Why has it cost so much? And I think that's purely down to the fact that, as Neil said, a lot of this stuff is handmade. These parts aren't available on shelves. These are parts from the 1940s that, if you're not fortunate enough to be able to find them, you have to make them. And by the time you've done that time and time again, the time frame involved with these things just adds up. And it's quite easy to lose a few years on a project like this. So I wouldn't necessarily say that any one system has been more challenging than another. Although the one thing that I would probably pick out, and I'll be interested to see if Neil agrees, the work that we've done on the wings. We actually completely de-skinned the underside of both wings, which is a mammoth task, and then carried out various repairs as necessary before re-skinning. And that's probably a project that's taken, well, over 6 months in its own right. And I'm not sure too many other people have gone about that in the same way. So that's probably the one thing that I would pick up on.
Yeah, it's a big job. I think you're right, Charlie. I can't think of any other C47 restoration that's gone that extra mile to de-skin the underside, to inspect fully the condition of the structure underneath. Yeah, so we've gone the extra mile, I suppose, which has cost us time. But we know now that those wings have been obviously repaired. They've been corrosion inhibitor have been applied to everything inside. Then obviously we've reskinned with brand new aluminium skins. Those wings are built now to last an extremely long time.
The restoration team is painting Knight Frights to its D-Day self. That includes the olive drab fuselage, the gray underbelly, invasion stripes, and the squadron markings. Jones discussed how the team is achieving that level of detail, down to the millimeter.
Yeah, so the actual colours themselves is dictated by Douglas specification standards, the DPS we call them, which gives us our kind of codes for the kind of the grey underneath and the olive drab for the rest of the exterior. Regarding then obviously the specific and individual markings on the aircraft, obviously the front of the aircraft had the 2-digit codes which indicated which particular squadron C-47 was in, S6, Sugar 6, for the 79th True Perry Squadron. So we've got, fortunately, a small handful of original photographs of Knight Frights during a wartime period. And that's the key, really, is literally studying those images and going down to the level of counting rivets to make sure that the beginning of the S starts at the right place. And then obviously you work aft to knowing where the end of the S would be, and then obviously you're basically doing measurements. You're doing scale drawings. I did scale drawings because we've done model kits, decals, as well, plus a 1/76th, well, sorry, a 1/72nd scale model with a company, a metal model. So those kind of scale drawings were then kind of resized up to 1:1 scale. They've been cut using kind of cardboard as a template and placed on the aircraft to see how that looks compared to those photographs. And they're looking good. Same thing happened then for the tail. Knight Frye's kind of radio letter was D for dog. Very interesting kind of way that they kind of drew the D back in 1944. We've done it again, counted rivets, compared it to the original photographs that we have. Luckily, we purchased a photograph on eBay that was being sold of Knight Frye. And it was such high resolution that we could really do a massive 1200 DPI scan of it and zoom in to give us extremely good detail regarding the serial number, which is in yellow underneath, and then the deeper dog in white above it. So it's been a little bit of known kind of processes regarding kind of how these aircraft were painted during the war out at Long Beach. And then obviously the interval markings for the squadron and tail code was at group level here at Membury Airfields back in 1944. And that's just so there's nothing documented. So I can't find, as a historian, I can't find any kind of like black and white documents dictating to the four squadrons of each group, this is how you will apply your squadron code and your radio tail letter. But luckily, the photographs has given us enough evidence and assistance to kind of apply the markings as close as possible to what they were 80 years ago.
Knight Frye sustained around 100 battle scars on D-Day. Walker's team is trying to honor those scars by keeping that original damage visible after the restoration.
But, you know, as part of the restoration, we've uncovered a few of those sort of historic details from, I think we touched on it last time, actually, for some of the, you know, the battle scars that, you know, we found in Knight Frye. And we're making sure that, you know, we try to preserve those as part of the restoration process, as well as obviously trying to make Knight Frye look you know, like she was on the 6th of June 1944, both externally and internally. We've left no stone unturned in terms of, you know, the original gear that Neil sourced for the interior of the aircraft, be that radio or navigator gear in the front end of the aircraft, right through to, you know, the original paratroopers in the aircraft cabin, you know, some of the first aid kits, some of the litters that we'll have in the back to showcase the various different roles that Knight Frye would have taken part in during that period.
Jones is also a World War II enthusiast. He recapped the context for the 79th Troop Carrier Squadron and the 436th Troop Carrier Group leading up to D-Day.
The 79th, as part of the 436th Troop Carrier Group, was restationed down at Membury Airfield in Berkshire in March 1944, primarily because the 101st Airborne was billeted in various villages and camps around Berkshire, Wiltshire. And it made sense that since Troop Carrier Command had been formed to support airborne operations, let's bring the C-47s closer to the airborne troops so they can at least do some practice drops for the months leading up to D-Day.
The two main missions of these C-47s were dropping paratroopers and towing gliders into combat. Knight Frye, as Jones explained, takes its name from the daring mission set.
Leading up to the June the 1st, missions got harder. You know, it went from squadron level to group level to wing level, where you're having masses of formations of C-47s flying at night as well, conducting kind of paradrops. And obviously glider tows. Now, glider towing at night in close formation was probably one of the scariest things that they could do. And I think that's one of the reasons why Knight Frye was called Knight Frye. The particular airborne units that was going to be dropped by those each individual group were brought close to the airfields and lived in tented accommodation for the few days before D-Day. Obviously, the weather kind of changed. D-Day was supposed to happen on the 5th of June, but got cancelled because of bad weather, more so because of the rough seas, and it would mean that the invasion troops landing by sea would be affected by the rough seas. But fast forward by 24 hours, and a weather window had appeared, and obviously Ike gave the green light for the invasion to happen. And that's when all squadrons of the 436 plus an additional squadron from the 437th participated on D-Day.
The flight from Membury to the drop zone was about 2 hours. Instead of flying directly over the channel and alerting German troops near the landing beaches, the C-47s approached the peninsula from the southwest.
Two squadrons flew the 502nd Parachute Infantry Regiment, 101st Airborne, into Normandy as one serial. And Blackfriars was one of those C-47s who dropped the 502nds at the drop zone as well. So they did a really, really good drop.
Night Fright sustained so much damage from the initial drop that she did not participate in the subsequent glider tow on D-Day. However, other planes from the 436th did.
So the glider tow was 50. There was 50 gliders and obviously 50 C-47s towing them. Now the para drops, there was two serials for the 436. Serial 39 was 36 aircraft, and serial 10 was 57 aircraft.
Flying 2 hours in a fully mechanical C-47 was a lot more labor intensive on the pilot's part than a 2 hour flight would be in today's cargo aircraft.
I mean, the way I would describe it, Steve, is it's like driving a modern day car with power steering and all its modern comforts to going back and flying, driving something that's, got no power steering and sort of less creature comforts, really. So, I mean, it's a tail dragger in terms of an aircraft, which makes it, to have a unique challenge, I suppose, particularly, on the ground. It's a large aircraft. It's a tailwheel aircraft. So that presents a challenge in terms of how you handle it and maneuver it, particularly in strong wind conditions. But once you get the aircraft into the air, it's nice to fly. Yes, it's sort of, I suppose it's big and heavy, and there is a lot more manual input, but once it's flying, I would just say it's an aeroplane, really. And if you do a lot of general aviation flying, or you're lucky enough to fly warbirds, then you would sort of be familiar with that experience. But I would say that, generally speaking, it's a very simple aircraft. It's yes, it's multi-engine, but it's piston engine, and it's very simple in its construction, and how you operate it. But I suppose, translating that into how we operate it in the modern day, obviously, in the 1940s, they were under, way more pressure than we are now. So we have the ability to be a little bit more careful and conscientious in terms of how we operate it, making sure that, we allow the aircraft plenty of time to warm up and cool down when we start it and shut it down, and make sure that we're not doing lots of, long climbs in the aircraft and descents. So being careful how we're managing the engines and how we're cooling them. We're not carrying as much, load in terms of, one, the number of paratroopers, and two, the amount of gear that they're carrying.
While the restoration will largely stay true to war-era avionics, the new Night Fright will have some creature comforts.
Specifically talking about Night Fright, the instrumentation in the cockpit is going to be very much focused to 1944 specification, as with the rest of the restoration. So what you're looking at would be familiar to someone who would have flown the aircraft in the 1940s, but with the addition, I suppose, of some modern gear. As an example, in the center of the instrument panel would have been a rectangular basic autopilot, and what we've done is we've recessed a modern GPS, a Garmin instrument behind that, but sort of plugged the face of that original autopilot over the top of it, so we can use the Garmin during flight, but when we're on location, whether it's an air show, a film set, etc., then we still retain that sort of authentic look and feel. And there's modern radios, but utilizing World War II jack boxes and transponders that need to be installed so that we're compliant with modern day rules and regulations. But not only that, the aircraft is fully IFR capable. So for example, if we wanted to come over and see you guys at Dover and take part in that air show, then we've got the ability to do that. So it's very much blending as much originality and authenticity as we can with sort of modern day rules and regulations. But anything that we do install that's modern, we try to disguise it in the best possible way. But yeah, I love flying it. It's I spent 10 years flying jets, and I love doing that. But it's like jumping in a car with a sat nav and just you know, pressing the buttons or putting your destination into the FMS. You know, you do that, and then you're relying on the aeroplane and its backup systems to do everything for you. And you can get away with doing that, of course. But with a C-47, you know, you're the one doing the flying and actually, you know, hauling it around the sky. So that's, I guess, what I would highlight as the main differences.
Navigation during World War II, however, was limited. Pilots just flew off an attitude indicator and a compass, and certain C-47s had a designated navigator on board.
There was a position in the aircraft for a navigator. Not every C-47 would have a navigator kind of assigned to each crew for a particular mission, especially if they're doing a formation flight of three. Maybe the lead would have a navigator. They'd have a briefcase full of maps for the particular areas they were flying. There was a drift meter in his navigator's compartments to drop a small little flare where he'd observe and see how much drift that was being incurred whilst they were flying the aircraft. An astro compass, obviously, to kind of check on star locations and positions. If there was a particular drop they were doing and there was a Pathfinder team that had dropped before, and they could set up an Eureka beacon, and the Rebecca antenna on the aircraft and the receiver on the aircraft would then kind of show them the location of the Eureka beacon, and the navigator could guide the pilots to the source of the transmission. So, yeah, it's like Charlie said. If you're doing GA flying, I suppose nothing's changed that much in the form of navigation in a way. If you're good with maps and everything, and knowing your kind of your airspeeds and positioning, that's how they did it back in the day, really.
The C-47 Skytrain is a tailwheel aircraft, meaning the main landing gear are under the midsection of the fuselage, as is conventional, but the third point of contact is at the tail rather than the nose of the aircraft. It's one of the larger tail draggers in existence, which creates unique challenges for the pilots.
Yeah, the sight picture is definitely very different. I mean, if you start with maneuvering the aircraft on the ground, I mean, firstly, the point you made at the start there is valid. It's large. It is a large aeroplane, you know, added to the fact that it is a tail dragger. So taxiing it around initially requires a lot of concentration. The view from the cockpit isn't great. I find myself almost pushing myself up on my tiptoes to actually make sure that I've got a good viewpoint from the cockpit, and obviously the wings are sort of a little bit swept and behind you, so you've got to take that into account when you're maneuvering the aircraft. And obviously wind is a massive consideration with tail draggers as well. That's probably one of the things, might be slightly unfair, but you know, people flying conventional nose wheel aircraft tend to pay less attention to where the wind is, particularly on the ground. So that's something that you need to, you know, you need to bear in mind every time you're taxiing a tailwheel aircraft, is where's the wind coming from? And then obviously where you're positioning the flight controls accordingly. You know, and then, yeah, once you've got the aircraft into the air, I would say obviously, you know, that's obviously being sort of, you know, old-fashioned and requiring lots of, you know, good old-fashioned, you know, muscle and manual input, as we just talked about. It's an aeroplane, but then obviously that changes again when you come into land. And as you say, you're you know, you have to bear in mind that the sight picture for the approach is, you know, is very, very different. You know, depending on the size and type of the tailwheel aircraft, there's various different types of approach you can make, whether it's a wheel landing, whether it's a three-point landing. You know, there's more likelihood of bouncing the aircraft depending on the type of aircraft, and then how you react to that if the aircraft does bounce, how you correct for that, how you position the you know, the flight controls. And you know, there's lots of different approach techniques that you can use.
Charlie mentioned his hyper-consciousness of the wind while he's taxiing a tailwheel aircraft. He explained the dangerous situation that could occur if the wind takes an adverse effect.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you can get into a situation which essentially is called a ground loop, you know, where the aircraft sort of, you know, blows the aircraft around in a circle, which is obviously not ideal. You know, that can happen in the taxiing phase, or it can obviously happen, you know, in the landing roll if you were to get that maneuver wrong. So, yeah, you're just constantly paying attention, you know, literally every time you make a turn, right, where's the wind coming from? Where do I need to position the flight controls to counteract that, so it's not lifting up the wing of the aircraft? and you know, potentially causing an accident, or you know, it's relatively common for a tailwheel aircraft to nose over if you get that wrong, and you can have a prop strike. So you know, there's lots of things to consider. And you know, you're right. When I was starting out on my flying journey, flying PA-28s, 172s, and moving on to multi-engine aircraft, and then on to jets. You know, I think certainly when you're taxiing around, that the wind is a very little consideration. Really, you just get on and do what you're doing. But with a tailwheel aircraft, you're very much more aware of your surroundings, and the wind plays a big factor in everything that you're doing.
As we approach D-Day's 80th anniversary, Charlie explains some of the festivities that American and British C-47s will participate in. During future anniversaries, Night Fright's schedule might look similar.
Yeah, the idea is that the celebrations kick off in the last week of May. There's a squadron of aircraft coming over from the US, actually, again. They came over in 2019, flying under the banner of the D-Day squadron, which is part of the DC-3 Society. I think there's going to be less of them this time. But the kickoff event is at a place called Shuttleworth at Old Warden, which is an American-themed fly-in and barbecue for the aircraft. And then over the coming days, the aircraft are going to be based between two airfields, one called North Weald in Essex, where there's essentially a very large World War II D-Day-themed ground show where the aircraft will be on display for members of the public to come and have a look at and walk through. There'll be some training taking place for the aircraft to fly in formation. There'll then be some air displays at Duxford, the Imperial War Museum. And at the moment, there's scheduled to be a round canopy parachute drop at Duxford as well as part of that. And then in the first week of June, the first or second of June, the aircraft will depart for Normandy and be based at Cherbourg for the next week or so, where there's various different round canopy drops taking place onto both the American and British drop zones from World War II, as well as obviously public access to the airfield, allowing members of the public to come and see the aircraft up close and meet the personnel involved with each aircraft. So yeah, it's going to be significant. Every anniversary of Normandy is big. The ones that fall on a particularly significant year, i.e. the 80th, are huge. I think Neil would probably agree it's hard to describe what the atmosphere and just how busy it is on the ground in Normandy until you've actually attended one of these anniversaries yourself. So, you know, it really is a big deal. There'll be, I'm sure, lots of heads of state around Normandy during that week. I think the airspace will be locked down on the 6th of June itself for some of those movements. And then I think there's the opportunity after that to go on and take part in various other events. I know the American contingent are heading on to Germany for an anniversary of the Berlin airlift. And then I believe they're going on further than that and taking in some other stops in Italy and various other locations. So I think the American contingent are on tour for about a month.
Though the hydraulic system setback scratched Night Fright's D-Day plans, Walker still hopes to get the aircraft flying before long.
In terms of a debut appearance for Night Fright, now that the D-Day AT deadline is going to slide, the next event we're slated to attend is a brand new air show called Sywell 24 here in the UK. So that's the weekend of the 22nd and 23rd of June. So at the moment, I think we're pretty optimistic about that. What would stop us doing that is any more disasters like we had with the hydraulic system. It's time. So that's slated to be certainly the public debut.
Beyond this summer, Charlie hopes to make Night Fright the centerpiece of a heritage museum at Membury.
The idea is to pay homage to the 436 troop carrier group, specifically because of their involvement at Membury, but, you know, just troop carrier command, you know, more generally. So, you know, we could use Night Fright as the centerpiece to tell that story and focus on all of the various airborne missions throughout World War II, and then, you know, use some of the artifacts that we've got to help us, you know, with that. So, you know, Neil is a collector of uniforms in particular. So, you know, there'll be some uniforms on display, as well as various other artifacts that we've collected. We've got lots of, you know, written and photographic documentation from the families of the pilots that operated Night Fright during the war. So we can certainly use those to create some very, very nice displays. There's a few other local collectors who are interested in working with us and displaying some of their artifacts. One in particular, a local historian called Roger Day, who's written a book about Membury titled Membury at War. So it's going to be a collection of, you know, lots of different artifacts that, you know, a few of us can put together. But, you know, Neil also has quite an extensive collection in his own right. And, you know, if I'm not speaking out of turn, I'm sure, Neil, some of those artifacts will probably make up, you know, some of that display.
Chief amidst Neil's World War II collection is an assortment of uniforms from members of the 436th Troop Carrier Group.
From pilots, glider pilots, radio operators, kind of the navigators, crew chiefs, to ground crew. So each one of those uniforms has a story, because I researched the name that's inside them and do a massive amount of research to find photographs and reach out to the families regarding their ancestors. And that's really what I want to kind of give to the museum in a way, is telling that story regarding that the men that were part of the 436 back in 1944-45. Each one of them has their own individual story. You know, I've had a couple of uniforms donated by family members, which we are so grateful for, which, you know, which are going to be on display. Glider pilots who got so seriously injured on landing on D-Day. The war ended once they returned back from that mission to a C-47 pilot, a co-pilot. His first ever combat mission was Market Garden Day 1, which was 17th of September 44. Got shot down. Broke his leg on bailout, but returned back to the group, back to Membury in time for other combat missions later on in the wars.
Charlie's Museum would be the first substantial heritage site at Membury, which was decommissioned as an RAF base in October 1946.
And you know, that really was part of our motivation in the first place, is, you know, to change, you know, the fact that, you know, people drive past the road here, well, they probably don't even realize there was some World War II airfield here. And, you know, they, not only that, they don't realize how significant that local history is, you know, what those men and women did in the 1940s, and, you know, how a lot of them lost their lives for our freedom, really. So, you know, that's really is going back to the core motivation of what we're doing and why, to remember those, you know, the greatest generation, and also use that to educate future generations so that sacrifice isn't forgotten.
When the time comes, Charlie hopes to take Night Fright back across the Atlantic and trace some of its roots, as well as its modern-day relatives.
Yeah, it's going to be a great trip. We're looking forward to it. We want to take Night Fright back to some of the places that are significant to the aircraft in the US. Dover, obviously, with the current 436 operations group being based there, is right at the top of the list. You know, we'd love to go as far west as where the aircraft was built, in Long Beach. I think that would be pretty cool. And then if we could take in some other air shows, you know, whilst we're on tour, you know, Oshkosh or Sun and Fun, something like that, I think that would be cool.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Bedrock Podcast. For more information on Night Fright and Membury Airfield, you can visit night-fright.com.